Advisors. I've been in a lot of meetings with him on foreign policy, a former State Department official told me. While I was in the room, he'd get phone calls from heads of state, and more than once I heard him say, "I can't believe I've got to meet with all these congressmen from Podunk City to get my bills passed." And when the meeting with him was over, it was over. No lingering, no schmoozing on the way out. There was no clinging to personal relationship, like with Bill Clinton. In his study of the presidency, Hail to the Chief, historian Robert Dallek lists five qualities that have been constants in the men who have most effectively fulfilled the oath of office. 1. Vision. 2. Political pragmatism. 3. National consensus. 4. Personal connection with the people. And 5. Credibility. Dallek places the greatest emphasis on numbers 4 and 5. "The best of our presidents," he writes, "have always recognized that leadership required a personal connection between the president and the people, or that the power of the Oval Office rests to a great degree on the affection of the country for its chief. From Washington to Lincoln to the two Roosevelts, and most recently Reagan, the force of presidential personality has been a major factor in determining a president's fate. Presidents who are unable to earn the trust of their countrymen are governors who cannot govern and lead." Barack Obama has been unable to earn the trust of his countrymen because he is, at heart, predominantly concerned with his own thoughts and ideas and feelings, rather than the thoughts and ideas and feelings of the people he was elected to serve. He believes that he was chosen as president to save a wayward America from its dependency on free market capitalism. This has led him to push clumsy and unpopular far-left policies, universal health care, Wall Street bailouts, cap and trade, green jobs, and renewable energy, at the expense of rational policies aimed at putting America back to work. Chapter 9. Ground Zero. She knows the buttons, the soft spots, the history, the context. Michelle Obama, speaking about Valerie Jarrett. "If it wasn't for Valerie Jarrett, there'd be no Barack Obama to complain about." The speaker was a member of the White House press corps who has covered the Obamas, husband and wife, since their early days on the political scene. My colleague and I were sitting in a Mexican restaurant in Washington, eating chimichangas and exchanging notes about Valerie Jarrett, or VJ, as she is known in the West Wing. Jarrett is ground zero in the Obama operation, the first couple's first friend and consigliere. Once asked by a reporter if he ran every decision by Jarrett, Obama answered without hesitation, "Yep, absolutely." Her official title is a mouthful, Senior Advisor and Assistant to the President for Intergovernmental Affairs and Public Engagement. But it doesn't begin to do justice to her unrivaled status in the White House. Nor does it explain her responsibility, which has gone largely unnoticed by the public, for the incompetence and amateurism that has been the hallmark of Obama's time in office. Jarrett occupies a piece of prime real estate in the White House, Karl Rove and Hillary Clinton's old office on the second floor of the West Wing. She has an all-access pass to meetings she chooses to attend. One day she'll show up at a National Security Council meeting. The next day, she'll sit in on a briefing on the federal budget. When Oval Office meetings break up, Jarrett is often the one who stays behind to talk privately with the president. At 6:30 on many evenings, Jarrett can be seen slipping upstairs to the family quarters, where she dines with the Obamas and their two daughters, Sasha and Malia. She is the only member of the White House staff who goes on vacations with the Obamas. She is also one of the few people in Washington, besides Michelle Obama, and Barack's live-in mother-in-law, Marian Robinson, who is on such familiar terms with the president that she can call him by his first name to his face. Valerie is the quintessential insider, one of her longtime friends told me. She functions as the eyes, ears, and nose of the President and First Lady. She tells them who's saying what about who, who's loyal and who's not. She advises them about who they should see when they visit a city or a foreign country. She determines who gets invited to the White House and who is left out in the cold. Jarrett is supposed to be the point person for the administration's efforts to keep in touch with the outside world, everyone from senators to foreign dignitaries. Obama sent her to talk to the Dalai Lama before he visited China. However, if you talk to Democratic donors, businessmen, congressmen, and African Americans, as I have, it turns out that Jarrett is far better at giving people the cold shoulder than at welcoming them with open arms. Like Obama, she has a fundamental lack of respect for businessmen. In a typical blunder that sent shudders through the business community, she dismissed Tom Donahue, the highly regarded CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as irrelevant, saying that she preferred to deal with real industry executives. "I have always thought Valerie was a liability," a prominent donor told the Washington Post. "I've talked to people in the White House about it, and they have agreed with me, but they are scared to say anything." Behind its no-drama facade, the Obama administration has been rocked by major personnel shakeups. Both the President and the First Lady have gone through several chiefs of staff. But Jarrett is still the indispensable person in the mix. When speculation arose that Jarrett might want the Senate seat vacated by Obama when he became president, Michelle put the kibosh on the idea. "I told her," said Michelle, "that I wanted her in the White House, in that position, that it would give me a sense of comfort to know that my husband had somebody like her there, by his side." The president has made it abundantly clear that he feels the same way. As he told the New York Times, "Valerie is one of my oldest friends. Over time, I think our relationship evolved to the point where she's like a sibling to me. I trust her completely." Trying to figure out Valerie Jarrett's mysterious hold on the President and First Lady is a favorite guessing game in the parlors and dining rooms of Washington. In part, her influence stems from the fact that Jarrett is the President's trusted watchdog. She protects the vainglorious and thin-skinned Obama from critics and complainers who might deflate his ego. No one gets past Jarrett and sees the President if they have a grievance, or a chip on their shoulder, or even an incompatible point of view. That goes for such high-profile supporters as Oprah Winfrey and Carolyn Kennedy, who have been largely frozen out of the White House because Jarrett believes they would use the opportunity of a meeting with Obama to push their own competing political agendas. In part, too, Obama views Jarrett as the voice of authentic blackness in a White House that is staffed largely by whites. Jarrett comes from the top rung of African-American society, and Obama, a man who struggled for years with questions about his black identity and status, has always been more than a little in awe of Jarrett's pedigree. No minority group is more conscious of social status than blacks. While whites often see the black population in the United States as monolithic, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Eugene Robinson, in his book Disintegration, The Splintering of Black America, sees not one, but essentially five distinct black Americas: a mainstream middle class, a large abandoned minority living in poverty and dysfunction, a small transcendent elite with enormous power and wealth, individuals of mixed race, and communities of recent black immigrants. Jarrett comes from the class of light-skinned, transcendent elites. "Among African Americans, there is a keen perception of the gradation of skin color," says Ronnie Flowers, who was Michelle Obama's hairdresser from the time she was 18 years old until she went to Washington. "It often determines how successful you are and what opportunities you are given. Michelle is darker. She's not from the class of so-called high yellow blacks." Many African American women are proud of the fact that she is a typical-looking black woman in hue and hair. Whereas Barack and Michelle Obama came from modest middle-class backgrounds, Jarrett sprang from one of America's most distinguished black families. the Robert Taylor Homes, the largest housing development project in America when it was completed in 1962, was named after her grandfather, a noted African-American activist. Her father, James Bowman, was a famous pathologist and geneticist, who was a member of Sigma Pi Phi, a national fraternity of high-achieving blacks that was founded in 1904. Her mother, Barbara Taylor Bowman, was a psychologist who helped found the Erickson Institute for Child Development in Chicago. Valerie attended Stanford University and the University of Michigan Law School, and was married for a time to the late Dr. Robert Jarrett, the son of famed Chicago Sun-Times columnist Vernon Jarrett, who was responsible for landing Valerie her first city job as Mayor Richard M. Daley's corporation counsel. For all their Ivy League degrees, Barack and Michelle Obama were originally social outsiders in Chicago, which boasts more black millionaires than any other city in America. The Obamas didn't break into the exclusive world of Chicago politics and money until Jarrett met Michelle and hired her to work for Mayor Daley. At the time, Jarrett was Daley's deputy chief of staff and was known in Chicago as the public blackface of the Daley administration. She talked the liberal talk, but she didn't walk the liberal walk, because she was essentially a creature of the Daley machine, said a former community organizer who worked with Jarrett. In addition, Jarrett was a member of the boards of exclusive cultural institutions in Chicago, such as the Symphony Orchestra and the Art Institute. Thanks to her high-level connections in the nexus of politics, culture, and money, she was able to introduce Obama to the affluent African-American and Jewish communities in Chicago. In the eyes of many African-Americans, however, Jarrett's elitist background helps explain her condescending manner and inability to help Obama where it counts the most, remaining on good terms with his diverse and far-flung constituencies. Growing up, Valerie had very limited contact with African-American working-class people, said a Chicagoan who worked with her. The closest she came to the mostly black South Side was when she drove through it in her Mercedes convertible with the top down. She never had to work her way up. Everything was handed to her because of her pedigree. She is naturally attracted to African Americans who have a pedigree like hers. I question her capability. I never felt that she was astute enough to do her job in the White House. Despite her impeccable social credentials, Jarrett's record before she went to Washington was spotty at best. After Mayor Daley made her Commissioner of Planning, she became embroiled in a massive screw-up in the city's public housing revitalization plan, which cost Chicago millions of dollars in overruns. Daley fired her without any explanation. "I've known Valerie since she became Commissioner of Planning," said a Chicago real estate developer. "She served her master. She was a functionary of her master, Richie Daley, and I didn't like her. She would be cunning and not straightforward. She was very tough on people. She'd go to the wall for Daley and make sure her boss's wishes were carried out. But her advice to Daley was damaging to other people and to her benefit in standing with the mayor. Her job was never policy, and she's never been an operational person. She was an implementer, and she made sure that her fingerprints weren't on things." Later, after Jarrett left City Hall, she became the CEO of Habitat Executive Services, where she earned $300,000 in salary and $550,000 in deferred compensation. She managed a federally subsidized housing complex that was seized by the government after inspectors found crime-infested slum conditions and widespread blight. Throughout her career, Jarrett has failed upward. Today, she is at the pinnacle of power as Michelle Obama's closest confidant and Barack Obama's political soulmate. When I asked the historian Doris Kearns Goodwin if she could think of anyone in the past who occupied such a special relationship with both the President and First Lady, she mentioned Harry Hopkins, one of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt's closest advisors. Other historians, searching their memory, came up with the name of Michael Deaver, who was a member of Ronald Reagan's staff and an intimate friend of Nancy Reagan's. But unlike Hopkins, who was the chief architect of Roosevelt's New Deal, and Deaver, who had a 30-year career working for Reagan, Jarrett came to her White House job with few, if any, achievements. Many insiders in Chicago and Washington find her friendly and pleasant enough, but off the record, they use almost identical words to describe her. She doesn't have the stuff to be a principal advisor to the President of the United States. She has no international experience and no background in economics or fiscal policy, said Michael Levin, the retired vice chairman of the global accounting firm KPMG, and a major force in Chicago's social and cultural institutions. There were people in previous Democratic administrations who were real heavyweights, but Valerie is no former Secretary of State Cyrus Vance. I was at dinner where Valerie sat at our table for 10 minutes, and I wasn't particularly impressed, said a major Obama donor. She didn't say anything interesting. I expected her to be smarter. She ain't no Karl Rove. Karl Rove would eat her for breakfast. Chapter 10. Valerie v. Rom. The first method for estimating the intelligence of a ruler is to look at the men he has around him. Niccolò Machiavelli. Not long after Rahm Emanuel returned to Chicago to run for mayor of the Windy City, a hard-bitten old Paul buttonholed him on a street where he was campaigning. "You're nobody's fool," the old Paul said. "So why did the White House reek of rank amateurism on your watch?" "I fucked up," Emanuel replied. "Bullshit," the Paul said. "I don't accept that excuse." "Why not?" Emanuel asked, taken aback. "Because nobody ever heard from the president while you were there. And yet you and I know that every politician's got a list on his desk of people to call," said the old Paul. "Every politician has such a list. Maybe 200, 300, 400 calls come into the president every day, and he can answer only 4 or 5 or 6. You need someone who knows how to make that list, the call list. You tell me Obama didn't have a list? I don't believe it. He had a list when he was raising money to run for the White House. You tell me that that list didn't exist anymore?" Emanuel tried to get a word in edgewise, but the Paul had worked himself into a lather and was in no mood to listen. "For Christ's sake, it was never your list anyway, Rom," he said. "During the primary campaign, you were working with the Hillary people. The Obama people had their own list. Why didn't Obama call people on that fucking list?" Emanuel thought for a moment, then said, "I guess it all comes down to one person. Who's that?" "Valerie Jarrett." By general consensus, Valerie Jarrett, the White House official responsible for public engagement, has conspicuously failed to engage. "I heard this complaint about Jarrett from practically everyone I interviewed for this book, Republicans and Democrats, African Americans and Jews. They all blamed Jarrett for keeping the president isolated, even from those whose good opinion he needed the most." This included the White House press corps, who found the Obama administration largely impenetrable. Journalists covering the president were like prisoners in Plato's cave. They watched shadows projected on the wall and believed they were viewing reality. Perhaps no reporter better insinuated herself into the White House than the New York Times' Jody Kantor, who did more than 30 interviews with current and former White House staff for her book, The Obamas. But when asked if she had ever seen the Obamas' White House private quarters, Kantor replied, "No, I can't even name a journalist who has ever been up there under the Obama watch." "Before Valerie left Chicago, we had a talk," said Hermine Hartman, the publisher of Indigo. "At the time, I was president of the African-American business group called ABLE, which had given significant dollars to Barack and had met with him every 3 to 6 months when he was a United States senator. And I wanted to continue that connection between us day one people and Barack. But Valerie said to me, 'I will meet with 6 people, but I won't meet with all 30 of the people in ABLE and listen to them bellyache.' And I said, 'We don't want to bellyache, we just want to talk. Let's talk about some boards we might be interested in and some appointments. But she wouldn't relent. We thought she would stay connected to Barack's black base in Chicago. It didn't happen. Some of my friends who gave money to Obama in 2008 complained to me that they never hear from him, that he doesn't call them, a prominent figure in Chicago's Jewish community told me. Well, he doesn't call me either. He never picks up the phone and calls me. He's not like Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton, who picked up the phone just to chat with you. Barack Obama isn't that kind of warm, fuzzy guy. He's cooler than that, a bit detached. He doesn't put his arm around you and slap you on the back. He's not a glad-hander. I wish he would call me, but that's not the kind of guy he is. There was no love lost between Jarrett and Emanuel when he was the president's chief of staff. Jarrett was aware that Emanuel had tried to block her appointment to the White House staff, and Emanuel knew that Jarrett didn't have much use for his one-hand-washes-the-other style of politicking. Blunt and famously profane, Emanuel is an unsentimental realist who operated as Obama's legislative brain. When it came to dealing with Congress, Emanuel was in favor of cutting deals and putting up numbers on the scoreboard. It was his job to give the president clear-eyed advice on how to get things done and to apprise him of the cost and benefits of his actions. However, at almost every turn, Emanuel was thwarted by Jarrett, who functioned along with David Axelrod as Obama's political brain. Axelrod and Jarrett were charter members of the cult of Obama. They had drunk deeply of the Obama Kool-Aid. They made certain that the president remained true to his roots as a big-spending, big-government liberal. When Obama retired in the evening to the family quarters, he would often turn to Jarrett and say, "Rom thinks this is the practical thing for me to do. What do you think the right thing to do is?" "There are always separate legislative and political operations going on in every White House," said Billy Tauzin, a veteran Washington lobbyist who is often described as a master of politics and policy. "In previous administrations," he said, "there's usually been a coherent meld of these two operations, some sort of broad strategy that was being managed. But that didn't happen in the Obama White House under Emanuel and Jarrett." "I haven't seen such incoherence in the White House since Jimmy Carter," Tauzin continued. "Whenever the legislative team struck a clear path, a clear understanding and agreement with the leaders in Congress, the political team didn't bother to track it or know about it. They acted as if they were in a completely different paradigm. They ran on a totally different track. That's one of the reasons there's been such frustration among Democrats as well as Republicans in Congress. They don't sense any coherence. The only thing consistent in this White House is that politics always trumps legislative policy. The major goal is whipping your opponent." In the bitter fights between Jarrett and Emanuel, Obama frequently sided with Jarrett and ignored Emanuel's advice. For instance, though Emanuel warned the president time and again that he didn't have the votes to ram a comprehensive single-payer health care bill through Congress, Jarrett, along with David Axelrod and First Lady Michelle Obama, persuaded the president to go for broke and side with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and her gaggle of left-wing Democrats. Just as Jarrett and her ideological compatriot Axelrod failed to foresee the emergence of the Tea Party, they didn't understand that an enormously complex Rube Goldberg machine, like Obamacare, needed to be explained to the public in simple terms. Emanuel tangled with Jarrett over her effort to put the prestige of the presidency behind Chicago's bid for the 2016 Summer Olympics. Emanuel was suspicious of Jarrett's motives. He believed she was working on behalf of her old boss, Mayor Daley, and his political cronies, who stood to benefit from the billions of dollars that would be spent on construction, tourism, sponsorships, and advertising. That idea seemed to be lost on the president. Always the pragmatist, Emanuel urged Obama to leave the Olympic crusade to others and deal instead with pressing national issues, such as skyrocketing unemployment, which was then reaching 10%. But Obama ignored Emanuel's entreaties and sided once again with Jarrett, who then persuaded First Lady Michelle Obama to fly with her to Copenhagen and make a dramatic presentation to the International Olympic Committee. "There won't be a dry eye in the room," said Jarrett, sounding shockingly naive. "I'm sure that it will touch the hearts of each of the IOC members." "The White House staff didn't want this to happen," said someone who was present during the debates over the Olympics. "They thought it was a loser, that it would be of no value to the president and his office. What's more, you never let the president go abroad without knowing the outcome in advance. But Valerie had a lot of relationships in Chicago, business and political, and she was still tied in with Mayor Daley." When it became apparent that the voting in Copenhagen was going to be dicey, Jarrett dropped the First Lady as Chicago's chief spokesperson. Instead, she turned to the president for help, arguing that he was the best brand in the world, and that only his star power and brilliant rhetorical skills could carry the day with IOC members, especially those from African nations. Easily flattered, Obama thought he could prevail by the force of his personality, and he flew off to Copenhagen, where he made an impassioned plea to the assembled IOC members. However, just as Emmanuel feared, when the votes were tallied, the Olympic Games were awarded to Rio de Janeiro, not Chicago, which finished fourth of four candidate cities. The loss dealt a stinging blow to Obama's international standing. Jarrett was on the wrong side of several other consequential issues, not the least of which was her stand on Solyndra, the California solar company that went belly up and cost American taxpayers $500 million. Shortly before Obama paid a visit to Solyndra, which had received a $535 million taxpayer-funded loan guarantee, Steve Wesley, a prominent venture capitalist and member of Obama's 2008 National Finance Committee, wrote Jarrett, "A number of us are concerned that the president is visiting Solyndra. There is an increasing concern about the company because their auditors have issued a warning letter. Many of us believe the company's cost structure will make it difficult for them to survive long term." Wesley wasn't alone in warning Jarrett about Solyndra. Lawrence Summers, the director of the president's National Economic Council, opposed the administration's loan guarantees to Solyndra, writing in a 2009 email that the government is a crappy venture capitalist. Nonetheless, Jarrett gave her stamp of approval to Obama's visit to the Bay Area solar company, where he used words that would come back to haunt him. "The true engine of economic growth will always be companies like Solyndra." 5 months later, the company filed for bankruptcy, making it the third U.S. solar manufacturer to fail in a month. As of this writing, Solyndra was under FBI investigation for accounting fraud. Why did Jarrett ignore the warnings from Steve Wesley and Larry Summers? "The process for this particular loan guarantee began under President Bush," said White House spokesman Eric Schultz, ignoring the fact that the Bush administration ultimately rejected the loan. A more honest answer to the question could be found in Valerie Jarrett's Chicago connections, especially her close ties to the George Kaiser Family Foundation, which controlled 35.7% of Solyndra. The foundation has made a sizable donation to the University of Chicago Medical Center, where Jarrett once served as chairwoman, and where one of Obama's best friends, Eric Whitaker, is currently executive vice president. Billionaire George Kaiser, one of Obama's top 2008 campaign fundraising bundlers, visited the White House no fewer than 16 times, and Jarrett herself met at least 3 times with Solyndra lobbyists, who pushed for government assistance. Jarrett's dubious judgment on Solyndra had one unintended consequence. It focused renewed attention on Obama's wrong-headed and naive approach to government stimulus spending on green energy projects. Even Brad Jones of Redpoint Ventures, an investment firm with financial connections to Solyndra, saw the error of Obama's ways. "The allocation of spending to clean energy is haphazard. The government is just not well equipped to decide which companies should get the money and how much," Jones wrote Larry Summers. One of our solar companies, Solyndra, with revenues of less than $100 million and not yet profitable, received a government loan of $580 million. While that is good for us, I can't imagine it's a good way for the government to use taxpayer money. Jarrett's lack of judgment in domestic affairs was matched by her inexperience in international and military affairs. She was out of her depth during the Obama administration's nearly year-long internal debate over how to deal with CIA intelligence that Osama bin Laden was hiding in plain sight in Pakistan. The Defense Department calculated there was a 40-60% chance that Osama bin Laden was living in a compound in Abbottabad, less than a mile from the Pakistan Military Academy. The way the compound was built, plus the human intelligence the United States had on the ground, led the intelligence community to conclude that the compound was at the very least a high-value target. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates wanted to drop bombs on it and obliterate it. The CIA argued that, whatever the risks, if the target was as valuable as the intelligence apparatus said it was, then there was no sense in wiping it out. The CIA didn't want to lose the valuable intelligence the compound might contain. Though Jarrett did not attend meetings in the Situation Room, she privately urged the president not to send in a Navy SEAL team. She told Obama that the raid could turn out to be a replay of 1980's Desert One, when President Jimmy Carter's effort to rescue American hostages in Iran backfired so badly that it helped doom the Carter presidency. In this case, Obama didn't listen to Jarrett. He believed strongly in what the CIA told him, and decided to send in the Navy SEAL team to capture or kill Osama bin Laden. It was a brave act, but Obama had at least one other motive. He was worried about what voters might think if they became aware he had had a chance to get Osama bin Laden and hadn't taken it. Neither the president nor his closest advisors came to Washington with experience managing a large staff, and they failed to hire a team of experienced people who knew how to run things in the nation's capital. As a result, many of the Chicagoans who staff the West Wing, including Valerie Jarrett, are strangers in a strange land. In this atmosphere of callowness and insularity, the Obama White House has assumed the trappings of a royal court. There is a tremendous amount of jockeying in the White House under Barack Obama, people hoping to push other people out of their positions, fighting over stupid stuff, a former high-ranking member of the staff told me. This fighting is not built around flattering the king and queen. It's about arousing suspicion in their minds. If the king and queen feel that they need someone to look out for them, it makes them more dependent. They want to know who is really behind them, who's really their friend. What is the Washington community saying? What is the black community saying? In all of this, Valerie Jarrett is both the arsonist and the firefighter, this person continued. She has been able to spread her tentacles into every nook and cranny of the executive branch of government. She creates problems so she can say to the president and first lady, I would do anything for you. I would put everything at risk to show you how trustworthy I am. The president, and to a lesser degree the first lady, are worried about big stuff, which means that they must depend more and more on the people around them. Valerie creates fear. She keeps the Obamas off balance and keeps them coming back to her. She makes sure that a lot of other people don't have access. She keeps old friends and supporters away. If she can't control you, what you're going to say to the president and the first lady, the issues you're going to push, then you're not going to get in. Only the people she feels she can control can get in. The people who are given access are beholden to Valerie. Every one of the current crop of people in the East Wing are her friends. They think they owe their lives to her. Fear is the operative word. When people on the staff hear that Valerie's in the family quarters, it scares them. What is she saying to the President and First Lady about me? Is she giving me credit for what I've done? Is she distorting what I've said? Valerie tells everyone that she's going up to the family quarters, even if she's only delivering a letter. Chapter 11. The Wrath of Michelle. My staff worries a lot more about what the First Lady thinks than they worry about what I think on a full range of issues. Barack Obama. Of all the ways the mainstream media have kowtowed to the Obamas, none has been more disgraceful than their coverage of Barack's marriage to Michelle. Typically, he is portrayed as the contented husband who is in total sync with his wife. She's depicted as an advocate for military families, a crusader against childhood obesity, the devoted mom to Sasha and Malia, and a creature of serene domesticity. In this storybook rendering of the Obamas' marriage, Barack runs the country, while Michelle keeps him grounded and takes care of the home. When they lay their heads down on their pillows at night, she might turn to him and offer a few household hints on how things could be managed a little better in the White House. But other than that, at least according to this version, Michelle is no Hillary Clinton. She's a traditional, hands-off First Lady. Recently, this insipid portrait of Michelle Obama has undergone some sorely needed revision. In The Obamas, by New York Times Washington correspondent Jody Cantor, a mainstream journalist acknowledges for the first time that Michelle is in fact an unrecognized force in her husband's administration. As Cantor writes, she was sometimes harder on her husband's team than he was, eventually urging him to replace them. And the tensions grew so severe that one top advisor erupted in a meeting in 2010, cursing the absent First Lady. In reaction to Cantor's book, the White House PR machine mounted a swift and vigorous campaign to re-sanitize Michelle's image. The First Lady herself went on TV and, in an interview with Gayle King of CBS This Morning, declared, "That's been an image that people have tried to paint of me since the day Barack announced, that I'm some angry black woman." Jody Cantor's journalistic amour propre was deeply wounded by the charge of racism. She defended her portrayal of Michelle, pointing out that she hadn't cast the First Lady as an angry black woman. "Those words aren't in the book," said Cantor. "There's nothing that implies she is. She is portrayed as a very strong woman. Barack Obama came to Washington on top of the earth and has kind of been descending to earth ever since, and Mrs. Obama came here with low expectations and exceeded them." Michelle exceeded expectations. Indeed, a close reading of the book makes it abundantly clear that Cantor admires the First Lady and thinks she has done a terrific job in a difficult role. The book may expose some of the First Lady's sharper edges and hint at her true role in the White House, but the author hardly lands a punch. So, what is the truth about Michelle? Not since Bill and Hillary Clinton burst upon the political scene more than 20 years ago, promising two for the price of one, have we seen anything like Barack and Michelle's partnership of power in the White House. There is, however, a crucial difference between the Clintons and the Obamas. Whereas the Clintons were open and above board about their co-presidency, boasting that Hillary was an equal partner with Bill, the Obamas have been careful to hide the fact that Michelle is the president's most important political advisor and the one he listens to above all others before he makes major decisions. Their stealth co-presidency has obscured a vital fact, namely, that the Obamas share a sense of entitlement, an attitude that they know best, a contempt for the political process, and a callow understanding of the way the world works. Their common worldview drives the president's agenda and has brought the United States ever closer to a European-style socialist welfare state. By any measure, Michelle Obama is further to the left politically than her husband. And that's saying a lot. Take the president's trillion-dollar budget-busting healthcare legislation. While presidential advisors Rahm Emanuel, David Axelrod, and Vice President Joe Biden all urged Obama to scale back on the unpopular bill, Michelle encouraged her husband's messianic impulses, urging him to save America from its wicked ways and press ahead, no matter what the consequences. The healthcare overhaul fit perfectly with their shared sense of mission, their joint idea that the president's career was not about pursuing day-to-day political victories, but the kinds of fundamental changes they had sought since they were young, Cantor writes in The Obamas. This was Michelle's most profound influence on the Obama presidency, the sense of purpose she shared with her husband, the force of her worldview, her passionate beliefs about access, opportunity, and fairness, her readiness to do what was unpopular and pay political costs. Every day he met with advisors who emphasized the practical realities of Washington, who reminded him of poll numbers. He spent his nights with Michelle, who talked about moral imperatives, aides said, who reminded him again and again that they were there to do good, to avoid being distracted by political noise, to be bold. The First Lady's handlers have painted a picture of Michelle as a woman who, throughout her marriage, has done everything in her power to discourage her husband from running for public office. This view of Michelle is accepted as gospel among the chattering classes on the East and West Coasts, where liberal conventional wisdom holds that Michelle Obama hates politics and politicians. "I didn't come to politics with a lot of faith in the process," she has said. "I didn't believe that politics was structured in a way that could solve real problems for people." Another time, she said, "I am tired of just giving the political process over to the privileged, to the wealthy, to people with the right daddy." And of course, there was her famous remark to Carlo Bruni Sarkozy, France's first lady, that her life in the White House was, "Hell, I can't stand it." Michelle denied having made the remark, but few believed her. Conventional wisdom aside, Michelle's comments raise some puzzling questions. If she hates politics so much, why did she hitch her wagon to a political star like Barack Obama, who had an insatiable ambition to achieve national public office? What can she possibly have against a political system that has brought her family nothing but financial fortune and unimaginable comfort, made her a celebrity as America's first black first lady, and put her on Forbes' list of the world's most powerful women? How can she say she hates politics when she is playing a major role raising money and delivering speeches on behalf of her husband's 2012 re-election campaign? Political wives have always found something to complain about. After all, politics is a blood sport, and spouses end up with many of the same wounds as their husbands. However, based on my reporting, I believe that Michelle's scornful attitude toward politics has far less to do with her life as a political wife than it has to do with deep-seated grievances that she has carried over from her childhood. Although you wouldn't know it from the way she talks now, Michelle LaVon Robinson came from a family steeped in politics. The Robinsons depended for their modest livelihood and fragile perch in the middle class on political connections. Her father, Frazier Robinson III, was a precinct captain in the political machine run by the original Mayor Daley, Richard Jay, who was the last of the big city bosses. In exchange for working as a precinct captain in Old Man Daley's corrupt Democratic machine, Frazier Robinson was given a low-level patronage job as a Chicago city pump operator. Precinct captains were the machine's foot soldiers at the neighborhood level. They delivered votes on election day and, if necessary, stuffed ballot boxes. When Michelle was growing up, the machine was dominated by Irish Catholics like Daley, who resisted racial integration and gave Chicago the reputation of being the most segregated city in the North. Despite Frazier Robinson's lifetime devotion to the regular Democratic organization, he and black folks like him were treated as second-class citizens. The South Side, where the Robinson family lived, had the worst schools in the city. When it snowed, their streets didn't get plowed. Uncollected garbage piled up on their sidewalks. Frazier, who suffered from a painful case of multiple sclerosis and needed two canes to walk, never missed a day of work. He hobbled about the neighborhood and listened to people tell him that they needed a parkway fence or another cop on the beat. But he didn't receive the raises and promotions that customarily came to white precinct captains. Frazier was a proud man who never complained about his disability or treatment. But Michelle grew up feeling sorry for him. She resented the political power structure that failed to recognize her beloved father's value. At night, when the Robinson family gathered around the dinner table, they often talked about how it was necessary to game the system in order to get along. If you wanted to hold on to your steady job in Mayor Daley's Chicago, you had to soil your hands in Democratic politics. As far as Michelle was concerned, however, the system was stacked against black people, and she didn't want any part of it. According to friends, Michelle was ashamed that her father worked in such a dirty business. Though she and Santita Jackson, the daughter of the Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., were inseparable friends at the Whitney Young Magnet High School, Michelle never admitted to Santita that her father was a precinct captain. Young Michelle spent many afternoons in the Jackson household, but she kept her father's job as a precinct captain a secret from her best friend. Michelle's cynical attitude toward politics was encouraged by her mother, Marion Robinson. Friends and neighbors say that Michelle got her attitude and biting sarcasm from her formidable mother. In the words of her son, Craig Robinson, currently the men's basketball coach at Oregon State University, Marion was a force to be reckoned with, a phrase that is echoed today by people who work with Michelle Obama in the White House. In his memoir, A Game of Character, Craig tells a story about his mother that's worth repeating for the light it casts on the formative influence that Marion Robinson had on her children. Once, a policeman stopped Craig and accused him of stealing the bike he was riding. Instead of taking me at my word, the policeman insisted on loading the bike into the back of his cruiser and driving me home so he could speak to my parents, Craig wrote. From downstairs, I called up to Mom that the policeman had accused me of stealing a bike, and when she came outside, I saw a look on her face that I'd never seen before. "Go on inside, Craig," she said, barely glancing at me, but stealing her eyes on the officer, preparing to read him the riot act. I stood watching from the front screened-in porch, and she must have talked to that policeman for 45 minutes. Then he pulled the bike out of the trunk, set it on the curb, and drove off. But that wasn't the end of it. The next day, Marion Robinson paid a visit to the station house. And the day after that, the policeman came to our home and apologized to me. Like her mother, Michelle doesn't let sleeping dogs lie. She often behaves as though others have let her down, and she's better than they are. Even on the rare occasions when people do meet her exalted standards, such as when whites came out and voted in large numbers for her husband in the Democratic presidential primary, Michelle can't help but let her sense of grievance show through. Thus, her most notorious remark, which she made in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, on February 18, 2008. "For the first time in my adult life, I am proud of my country, because it feels like hope is finally making a comeback." Everyone in Michelle's family is afraid of her. "My mom and I and my dad, before he died, we were all worried about, oh my God, my sister's never getting married because each guy she'd meet, she's going to chew him up, spit him out," Craig Robinson said. "So I was thinking, Barack says one wrong thing and she is going to jettison him. She'll fire a guy in a minute. Just fire him." Later, after Michelle and Barack married, Craig was asked if his brother-in-law used a nicotine patch to help him quit smoking, to which Craig laughingly replied, "Michelle Obama, that's one hell of a patch right there." Despite her fiery reputation among friends and family, stories about Michelle's temper have rarely appeared in the liberal mainstream media, which have gone out of their way to protect her. A reporter has to dig hard to find people who are willing to talk about their encounters with Michelle. Here are three first-hand accounts from people who have witnessed the wrath of Michelle. From a Harvard Law School classmate of Barack Obama's, who asked to remain anonymous. When Michelle came to visit Barack at Harvard, He was living in a run-down basement apartment in a working-class neighborhood called Somerville, where he socialized almost exclusively with other African Americans. The furniture was cobbled together from God knows where, and you'd sit on a chair and it would break. He had an old Toyota, which Michelle drove around. It used to break down, and they argued about it all the time. Barack was treated specially by a lot of people at Harvard, and Michelle found that hard to handle. His ego was pretty inflated, and Michelle would fly in from Chicago, and the first thing she'd do was take him down a peg or two. She laughed at his pretentiousness. But she couldn't change the fact that he was immensely popular. He was handsome and successful, and incredibly well-spoken. His classmates, black and white, flocked to him. He was a guy with a slick way with words, and women especially were attracted to him. I remember one time Michelle showed up unexpectedly at his desk in the library and found him surrounded by women. It was terrible timing, and Barack looked like the proverbial cat who swallowed the canary. He had a really pained expression on his face. He had been working his ass off studying, and girls that he knew from classes happened by just as Michelle showed up. Michelle was so damn mad that she put a hand on his shoulder in a possessive way, then gave him this disdainful look, turned on her heels, and marched out without a word, her heels clicking on the marble floors. She went back to Chicago. Another time, the same sort of thing happened at his Somerville apartment. She came in and found him with some women, black women. Michelle threw a fit and left. He followed her down the street, Charles Street, begging her to stay. I think she drove a lot of Barack's friends away. If she didn't find them helpful, she would simply be rude. She and Barack had constant fights, and they could be incredibly exasperated with each other. Frankly, I was surprised the relationship lasted through law school. I remember thinking, this isn't going to work. For a while, Michelle was very unsure about the relationship. Barack seemed to have his life the way he liked it, and she wanted to remake him. But soon after Barack graduated from law school, and the world started beating a path to his door, Michelle decided he was going to go far, and she insisted that he marry her. He got cold feet, but Michelle wouldn't take no for an answer. She was a formidable woman even back then. From Charles Thomas, a veteran political reporter for Chicago's ABC News affiliate, ABC 7. I accompanied Obama on a trip he made to Africa in 2006, and when he returned, Time magazine did a cover story on him with the cover line, "Why Barack Obama Could Be the Next President." The morning Time's story appeared, Michelle had a previously scheduled interview on our local ABC TV news show. Her people told our people that we couldn't ask her about the Time cover story. But my editor told me to go down to the green room and see if she would comment about it. So I went down to the green room. I asked, "Michelle, how are the kids? We want to talk to you about the Time magazine piece." And she rose up out of her chair. She's a lot taller than I am. And she put her hand on her hip and glared down at me. Waving her forefinger at me, she said, "Charles, don't you try that shit with me, or I'll walk out of here." From African-American talk show host Tavis Smiley. About 5 years ago, I published a book, The Covenant with Black America, and I got PBS to let me moderate a primetime nationally televised debate in which the candidates were questioned only by journalists of color on issues of interest principally to people of color. All the candidates showed up. All the big-time Hillary supporters and all the big Obama people were there. The debate took place at Howard University, and afterward, the media said Hillary had killed Obama and gotten the most applause. After the debate, with the cameras still rolling, the candidates were on stage shaking hands. And in the midst of all this, Michelle Obama comes up on the stage and grabs me by the back of my jacket and yanks me backward and gets in my face. "Why are you messing with Barack?" she yells at me. This is in front of the auditorium with thousands of people. "You were unfairly tough on Barack," she says. "You should know as a black man what he's up against and what he's trying to do." And she proceeds to lay into me. I had to leave her standing there because it was getting really testy. If Michelle ever had any reservations about Barack's grandiose political dreams, they didn't come from her qualms about politics, but from her belief that he wasn't aiming high enough. For example, when he ran for a seat in the Illinois state legislature, Michelle told him that it was too small time. Remarks a friend of the Obamas. They both already knew so many important people, and she just wanted him to go straight to the national stage. For the first several years of their marriage, Michelle and Barack lived in a flat, in a lower middle-class neighborhood. But after Barack's memoir, Dreams from My Father, hit the bestseller list, and he joined the United States Senate, the couple moved to a million-dollar mansion, and Michelle landed a cushy job at the University of Chicago Medical Center, with a salary of $317,000 a year. Footnote. Michelle's actual annual salary, between the university and serving on six boards of directors, including Walmart, approached $500,000. It hardly seemed a coincidence that Valerie Jarrett was the medical center's chairwoman, and that a hospital board member, Kelly R. Welsh, was an executive vice president at Northern Trust Company, which had extended the Obamas a $1.3 million home mortgage. Chicago-style cronyism marked Michelle's tenure at the University of Chicago Medical Center. Given all her righteous talk about fundamental change, access, opportunity, and fairness, everyone expected Michelle to promote programs to assist the underprivileged denizens of the Black South Side. Instead, she helped launch a program, dubbed the South Side Health Collaborative, to save the hospital millions of dollars by redirecting poor and uninsured patients from its emergency room to surrounding community hospitals in the South Side. The University of Chicago's medical center beds were reserved for prosperous patients who used profitable procedures. The president of the American College of Emergency Physicians, Dr. Nick Giriles, released a statement saying Michelle's program came dangerously close to patient dumping, a practice made illegal by the Emergency Medical Labor and Treatment Act, and reflected an effort to cherry-pick wealthy patients over poor. To deflect criticism, Michelle gave the program a more appealing name, the Urban Health Initiative, and hired a public relations firm co-owned by David Axelrod, who was soon to become Barack Obama's chief strategist for his presidential campaign. Axelrod's job was to sell the Urban Health Initiative to community skeptics like Edward Novak, president of Chicago's Sacred Heart Hospital, who described Axelrod's PR efforts to justify the program as bull. As for Michelle's moral imperatives, a survey by the polling firm Peter D. Hart Research Associates noted, more than a few staff members, particularly medical staff, expressed strongly worded concern or disappointment with UCMC in its commitment to the community. Though Michelle now likes to pretend that she plays no part in personnel decisions or in formulating policy in the White House, the facts tell quite a different story. Michelle's aides meet regularly with the president's senior communications team and select public events that will maximize and reinforce the Obamas' joint message. According to a New York State Democratic Party official, Michelle certainly played a role in selecting Joe Biden instead of Hillary Clinton as her husband's vice presidential running mate. "Do you really want Bill and Hillary just down the hall from you in the White House?" Michelle asked her husband. "Could you live with that?" He couldn't. Also, according to one of Barack's closest confidants, Michelle was one of the strongest voices arguing for the appointment of Federal Appeals Court Judge Sonia Sotomayor to replace retiring Associate Justice David Souter on the Supreme Court. The First Lady thought Sotomayor had all those qualities her husband was looking for in an appointee, the confidant said. Barack has always listened to what she has to say. Michelle rarely conveys her opinions directly to the president's staff. When she is upset about something, she generally turns to her best friend, Valerie Jarrett, and makes Jarrett the messenger of her displeasure. Such was the case in the fall of 2010, when the story broke that Michelle had told Carla Bruni Sarkozy that she can't stand life in the White House, that it was hell. Robert Gibbs, Obama's longtime press secretary, worked furiously to put out the fire and get the Élysée Palace in Paris to issue a denial. He accomplished the task, but apparently he didn't do so quickly enough to satisfy Michelle Obama. The next day, at the president's 7:30 a.m. staff meeting, Valerie Jarrett